In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 396. We're joined once again today by Scott Horton, because I wanted to talk about what's going on in the Middle East, get an update on the Iran situation, maybe talk about Yemen, see what else we can talk about. Scott is one of the most popular guests I have on this show. He is the host of Anti-War Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and KUCR 88.3 FM in Riverside, California. He also hosts The Scott Horton Show on the Liberty Radio Network, Monday through Friday, 12 noon to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. You can check them out at lrn.fm. And of course, follow Scott over on his website, scotthorton.org. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Well, I'm suffering from Scott Horton withdrawal. We haven't had you on in quite some time. All kinds of things in the news, and I thought, well, time to get Scott back here and talk about them. It's kind of a potpourri episode, although I have primarily two topics in mind. The second one will be Yemen. I find that Yemen is one of these topics that I told you before we went on. It's like Bosnia in the mid-1990s. Like, everybody felt like they should know about it, but every time they started to learn about it, their eyes glazed over and they gave up. So this show will be a chance for people to get the basic gist, all they need to know about what's going on over there. But before that, this deal with Iran, it seems like I've been talking about this forever. The issue just doesn't die down because it continues to attract controversy. You continue to have neoconservatives trying to undermine it. So I thought maybe we could talk about where things stand right now and what are the neocons up to with regard to it. What are the goods and bads about the deal? I saw, by the way, a video of Marco Rubio questioning John Kerry. Now, this is talk about not much to choose here. But I have to say, John Kerry, to my mind anyway, made Rubio look like an uninformed idiot, which I suppose isn't that difficult, but it was really embarrassing. Like, you're going to go up against John Kerry, at least know what you're saying. So tell me what's the deal basically promising, and what is the neocon objection?
Yeah, well, first of all, yes, anyone who it's even possible for John Kerry to make an ass out of them. John Kerry has got a real problem.
Yeah.
All right. So here's the thing. I'm trying as hard as I can to get better at saying all this as quickly as possible and still make sense, Tom. But the bottom line of all this, and we could get to footnotes someday if you want to get into all the details. But the bottom line is Iran never had a nuclear weapons program. They had a civilian nuclear program that is allowed. It's their quote-unquote unalienable right under the Non-Proliferation Treaty that they're a part of ever since the 70s, back when they were our allies, and we gave them nuclear reactors in the Ford years. And they've never been found in violation of their safeguards agreement to the IAEA, which is mandated under that Non-Proliferation Treaty. And in other words, everything that you've ever heard about the threat of the Iranian nuclear program is just a bunch of hype. It's basically all spin with no real problem there. They have a civilian, the difference between enriching to industrial grade for your electricity program and making uranium for a nuclear weapon is vast. It's 3.6% or 3.7% versus above 90% pure uranium-235 to even be able to make a nuclear bomb. And they haven't done that, and we know they haven't done that because the IAEA has had them, quote-unquote, safeguarded all along, verifying and accounting for all of their nuclear material. And they have said a million times over that they have verified the non-diversion of this nuclear material. And so all the nuclear deal that Obama and John Kerry are negotiating with the Iranians right now, they're basically negotiating for the Americans to finally recognize that. and lift the sanctions and leave the Iranians alone about it. And in exchange, the Iranians get to let them save face by scaling back their nuclear program somewhat, but not really changing the nature of it at all, because it never was for weapons in the first place. So I know that's not the spin you usually hear on it, but this is basically just the Americans finally conceding that, okay, they have the right to a civilian nuclear program, and there's actually nothing that we can do to get them to not have one. So, okay, we'll just go from a safeguarded to extra super safeguarded nuclear program. That's all the deal is. And the only reason that the Israelis and their partisans in America refuse, meaning the entire Republican Party and the whole Israel lobby and the neocons and all that, the only reason they're against it is because they need an enemy. Simple as that. War is the health of the state and yada yada, like you're used to hearing. And it's the same for the Israelis as it is for the Americans. This is how we sell planes. This is how we change the subject from domestic problems like the occupation in Israel, like the disastrous consequences of America's wars for us back home, like we have here, is, you know, the Iranians are a great little substitute, little miniature substitute for the USSR and for the Israelis, I guess, you know, for Syria and Hezbollah or whatever. And so they have an interest in keeping the thing going, but it's not an interest based in reality. It's not the national interest of the United States of America. It's just corrupt interest. And Netanyahu himself, in fact, I have it here so I can tell you all about it. Netanyahu himself, the prime minister of Israel, is in Haaretz. He held a cabinet meeting with his national security cabinet, and at multiple sources, it wasn't a matter of controversy whether these quotes were legitimate or not at the time. It's just a couple of weeks ago. And Netanyahu said his biggest fear is that Iran will honor the nuclear deal 100% and that he'll stick with it for 15 years and they'll never break it. And we won't be able to catch them cheating because they won't cheat. And then the real danger is then after 15 years of acting like a normal country in a normal time in within the international system to whatever degree, a greater degree, obviously, than current, then they'll sneak up on us after 15 years of acting fine and being treated as such and gaining influence and power in the Middle East overall. So that's the best threat they can come up with. Not a nuclear strike, but that there never will be even an Iranian nuclear weapons program. And that's how they get you. That's what the war party is left with now, which ought to be, you know, the end of the argument, although it doesn't seem to be.
Well, supposing that some of the Likud people in Israel, for example, do believe that what they're saying about Iran being an existential threat and that they do believe that there is a strong possibility that they'll acquire nuclear weapons capability and so on, then you would think then that an Israeli attack on Iran would have to be coming in the coming months, given that my understanding is that Russia is going to be providing Iran with anti-aircraft capability, which would neutralize potential air attacks. So you would have to get those air attacks in pretty soon if this really is an existential threat. If they don't launch an attack in the next few months, wouldn't that prove to us that they never really believed it was an existential threat to start with?
Possibly. I mean, but then again, I don't think that the Israelis necessarily have the capability to do that. I mean, when you say you better attack them now before it's too late, kind of rhetorically there, it's really the United States that has the capability to really attack Iran. And it would be a major operation, not the kind of thing that the Israelis could sustain on their own. The only way for them to do it would be to do it in a way to, you know, necessitate an American response, you know, somehow provoke the Iranians into striking back at American targets or Saudi targets in the Gulf, that kind of thing, and draw the Americans in, which, by the way, was Dick Cheney's plan, according to Seymour Hersh, the best of them. Dick Cheney and them did discuss using special forces in the Gulf to attack the U.S. Navy and use that as an excuse to attack Iran. And so, you know, this kind of thing can happen.
I could follow up on that, but I think that speaks for itself. What did you make of the whole Tom Cotton fiasco? It's kind of old news now, but this guy came out of nowhere, more or less. He came out of obscurity to neoconservative stardom with his whole stunt trying to put a monkey wrench in the works of the agreement with this kind of arrogant and annoying letter to the Iranian regime, condescendingly explaining the way our Constitution works about the role of Congress. It's funny for the neoconservatives all of a sudden to be deeply concerned about the role of Congress in the making of foreign policy.
Yeah. Well, I think the major lesson from that is that this guy, Tom Cotton, is going to be a real problem for peace and liberty basically from now on. I mean, he's the new John McCain. I don't know what could ever get rid of him. Maybe if something could make him unelected somehow, Tom, I don't know. But it seems to me like the worst thing America has going right now is this senator, because he's basically Bill Kristol's little sock puppet. And apparently was actually trained by second generation Straussians in all Straussian theory and this and that. And as a liberal writer, I don't like put it, he is Ted Cruz, but with a combat record. Basically, he fought in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And he's just he's the mirror image, the 6.5-foot walking talking point of the worst of the American neoconservative movement, you know, Bill Kristol and them at the Weekly Standard. And so, you know, that's the major lesson for me, is watch out for this Tom Cotton guy from now on, man. He is going to be such a thorn in the side of everybody who cares about peace and freedom. And then the second thing about it is, well, thankfully, it didn't really work. And the Iranian negotiators just played it off. And he really didn't have it right. Maybe it's just a technicality, but the Senate has advise and consent powers, but it's really the president that actually ratifies the treaty. Even if he had already signed us up for it, he only ratifies it after the Senate gives its advice and consent, which is kind of different. But then also, they completely, he and Rand and the rest of them who signed that letter, neglected the fact that The rest of the entire permanent membership of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany were going to be signing on to this thing, the P5 plus one, and then with a UN Security Council resolution, and the entire European Union and the United Nations have their own sets of sanctions that they have put on Iran at American behest, of course, all along, but they're lifting them. The deal is basically done. And at that point, the deal is with the so-called international community. And not just the Western powers, but the entire UN Security Council. And at that point, it's really a question of whether even Jeb or Hillary, when they come next time, could undo this deal. And so I don't know if Cotton thinks that Marco Rubio is going to be our next president, but I'm here to tell you he's not.
Well, speaking of which, I wasn't planning to ask you about this, but what the heck, I like to just go where the conversation leads me. What do you make of the lineup for the GOP nomination? I don't understand why half of them are even in the race. I can't tell most of them apart. What's the point of entering except, well, what's the point ever of entering except for personal aggrandizement and narcissism, I suppose?
Yeah. And, you know, if you ask me, the whole thing is locked up for Jeb anyway. And you know what? It's puzzling to me why people can't understand this. I guess people actually think that there's a democracy and this and that and people power and pluralism and all that. You know, I had a junior high school civics teacher junior college civics teacher who really it's funny how you can conflate those two together so easily. I can't. She just really believed in all this democratic pluralism stuff and whatever. And the thing is that the factions that choose the American president are not represented in primaries and caucuses in the 50 states. It's the bankers and the insurance companies and the arms dealers and the pharmaceutical companies, big agribusiness, and of course, Israel. And then maybe at the fringes, the gun lobby and the AARP, you know, retired people, Social Security lobby. Other than that, that's as close as you get to public participation at all is through the gun and the Social Security lobbies. Other than that, the whole thing is locked up by the oligarchical special corporate interests. And, of course, the state itself, which is millions and millions of voters, you know, that line up and donate and with the our tax money and all of that. So, you know, that's how these things are chosen. And so I don't see anyone on the top tier with Jeb other than Jeb. I guess they say Scott Walker, but I don't know enough about him. Maybe he is a top tier candidate, but the rest of them are nothing but second tier. And I don't see why any of them would ever be able to rise above that. Not that Jeb has any good qualities, but just that he has all the major factions locked up just because he's inherited this entire network, this entire system of donors and money and trust of the Bush family brand on the right in America. So I don't see how he could possibly lose unless he, you know, gets, I mean, there are individual stunts that could get him in trouble, right? Like if he gets caught saying the N-word in front of an open microphone or something like that, then go down in smoke. But other than that, I don't know how he could lose. And then when it comes to him versus Hillary Clinton, I just think that after a year and a half of being told how inevitable she is, she's going to not be very inevitable at all. Even her last book tour had like 1/10 of the actual turnout from the one before or something like that. Like, she's already old news before this thing ever starts. So I think she's going to have a real hard time. I think she's probably got the Democratic nomination locked up, but I don't think that she'll be able to beat Jeb in the general. And so there you go. I mean, I'm just speculating, but it seems pretty easy to see why everybody, you know, the so-called second-tier candidates, as you said, they're basically, you know, a bunch of blobs. And so what about them makes them special enough to beat out Jeb? Yeah, nothing. Yeah, and you know what it is? Look at John McCain in 08, the liberal centrist Republican that nobody likes, that's guaranteed to be the nominee in the end, who had the lowest poll numbers all year long until it came time to actually choose the nominee, and then there he was.
Yeah, and I remember seeing people on the news saying, well, I'm not – it was in 2008 – the election was still going on. The primaries were still going on. McCain had emerged as the clear front runner. And a guy is being interviewed on TV saying, well, you know, I'm not happy about it, but I guess I have to go down and vote for John McCain now.
No, yeah, no,
like, what
as
is
that.
Wrong with you? Why? Why do you have to vote for John McCain now? That's ridiculous. You know, I guess we have to say a little something about Rand Paul for just a minute, because it's just you can't avoid it. I just want to say on this general subject, you've now got a whole slew of people in the race and another slew set to enter. You've got Mike Huckabee, you've got Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, and a bunch of others. And to my mind, they're basically indistinguishable. I mean, Mike Huckabee is more of an economic populist than the others, but really, they're pretty much indistinguishable. Now, if you're Rand Paul, you could be thinking to yourself, let's say 6 months ago, that for strategic reasons, I've got to moderate my rhetoric so as to broaden my appeal. Now, I understand that. I don't agree with that strategy. I think it's self-defeating, but I understand why you would do it. But at this stage of the game, I no longer even understand it. I'm not saying that I don't agree with it anymore. I never agreed with it, but at least I understood it. I don't understand it at all anymore, because at this point, everybody in the race, as anyone could have predicted, is an ultra hawk. Everybody's an ultra hawk. So everybody, the idea that, well, I will appeal to some of the hawks by being a little cagey about my views can't possibly work. Somebody who's super concerned about hawkishness has a million other options other than Rand. So the only way he can distinguish himself is by saying this whole thing has been a hugely expensive and enormously unsuccessful policy by any conceivable standard. And anybody who on this stage is going to continue to peddle it to you is just another typical BS, big government, government propaganda liar. I mean, like, you can spin this in a way, in a populist way that would appeal to some undecided Republican voters. There is a group of people that no one's even trying to reach out there. No one's even trying to get them. And I feel like now Rand has put himself in a position where he can't even plausibly try.
Yeah, well, listen, I think you hit the nail right on the head there. And, you know, and the kind of unstated premise underlying all of that, of course, is that the war party is completely full of it. And peace is what is actually right. And any time that they want to actually try to, you know, pin Ron Paul on Rand and say, well, your father says this, what do you say about that? He ought to just be more than happy to say, hell yeah, of course. What are you, crazy? You know, my father's been right about this since 1996, let me tell you, and go ahead and give him some quotes. So, you know, obviously telling the truth is a lot easier than telling a lie. You know, he got all upset at the reporter lady for saying, how come you keep flip-flopping on Iran? And he got mad at her and said, I did not. Well, come on, man, you flip-flop all over the place on Iran. Nobody knows what you mean, but they know that you'll say anything. So let's get back to flip before flop, I say. And you know what? I'll say one more thing about this, and I'll let him off the hook and let you off the hook for letting me talk about him here. And that is that Rand Paul was on the Megyn Kelly show defending himself from accusations of sexism for yelling at the reporter lady for calling him out on his Iran flip-flop. And so Megyn Kelly had him on to kind of let him off the hook, I guess. But part of the interview was she hit him with Krauthammer and said, well, Krauthammer says that you have a Democrat-like foreign policy and you're, you know, the weak sister up here and that you're just like Obama and Hillary. How can you possibly live that down? So Rand was stuck. I mean, I guess he could have said, no, I swear I'm just as bad on Iran as Krauthammer is. Please forgive me. But, he was kind of in a thin-skinned sort of a mood that week, I guess.
Oh, that's too bad.
And so
what he could have said,
he fought. But
why didn't he just say, well, look, Hillary supported Krauthammer's ridiculous war, so it's Krauthammer.
Well, but so that's the thing. Wait, but that's the punchline. So instead of pandering, because his pandering, you know, talking points weren't available, I guess, he just told the truth and said, well, Krauthammer agrees completely with Hillary and Obama on the wars in Libya and Syria, which I warned against. And look how badly they've turned out. They spread jihad all over the place and this and that. And the moral of the story is that if Krauthammer himself had been there, Rand would have still whooped him. I mean, even with Megyn Kelly as the stand-in, it was, you know, not even a fight. But in other words, and in fact, he even repeated the same kind of message on the Sunday morning news show. This is now 2 weeks ago, I guess, where he goes, nuh-uh, it's the neocons who are like Hillary and Obama. They want to do like Hillary and Obama only times 10. So now he's attacking them from the right and making them big government, liberal, Wilsonian, make the world safe for democracy, nation-building Democrat types, marginalizing the neocons and claiming conservatism, which is perfect. So why pander on Palestine? Why pander on Iran? Why pander on any of this stuff when all he has to do is just tell the truth and kick everybody's ass? And he proved it just the other day.
Yeah, it can be done. And I've thought to myself, this will never happen, Scott, so don't pack your bags just yet. But if Scott Horton were briefing Rand Paul on talking points, I want to see Rand mop the floor with these people. Like, he's not going to win the warmonger vote, but he can have one heck of a great old time getting a lot of attention for himself, spreading a lot of great information, and getting a lot of excitement among young people. Yeah, he'll get some young people because they liked his father. But I'm talking about excitement. I'm talking about I'm going to take 8 months off and just go out there and work for this guy kind of excitement. You know, I'm gonna get in a Winnebago and go across the country. I'm gonna ride my bike back and forth across the whole country. That level of excitement comes only with this kind of stuff. It doesn't come with a launch speech talking about how I wish all the congressmen would obey the bills that they pass, or I wish the congressmen would read the bills that they pass. Well, okay, yeah, that's really sweet and everything, but what is it that got people excited about Ron Paul? It was that he was a fearless truth teller. And I guess what frustrates me also is so many people who say, well, you know, we loved Ron, but, you know, he didn't pass any bills and he wasn't successful. He was just running an educational campaign. Now we got to run to win. And by running to win, what they apparently mean is they want a campaign. I'm not even implicating Rand in this. His own supporters want a campaign in which he runs away from things, in which he is very diplomatic about certain things. And by the way, I know how to talk to right wingers to get them to think twice about what they believe about foreign policy and stuff. I know it because I've done it. It can be done, and I'm not saying that it's a bad idea to try. I'm saying it's a bad idea to be unclear, to be here, to be there, to try to balance all this. You know, that's exactly what we loved Ron for, was that he did none of that. That's why we loved him. So I don't understand how the same people who loved Ron can now be advocating the exact opposite strategy. Because how do you pitch that strategy to somebody? I can pitch Ron's strategy to an average person by saying, look, listen to every speech given by every other candidate. He's going to say, you're awesome. America's awesome. Right? Mothers are awesome. Barbecues are awesome. Vote for me. But then listen to Ron Paul. He's going to try to educate you about what's happening to your money, about the phony baloney foreign policy. He's going to tell you things no one else is going to tell you, and he doesn't care. He's going to stand his ground even when the whole audience boos at him. I can pitch that to somebody and they'll say, wow, that's a very unusual guy. But if these people who want Rand running an unclear campaign, what do they want me to say? Well, you know, he kind of doesn't want war, but if it's ISIS because they're chopping some heads off, that you got to kind of go to war against. But and maybe Iran, well, we don't want this deal, or maybe we do. But I mean, like, how do I pitch that?
Right. Yeah, good on Libya and Syria, but bad on Iraq and Iran.
Right, so in other words, with Ron, it was a consistent, clear, satisfying message that made internal sense. Now, I say this, by the way, Scott, not intending to have brought this up at all, knowing that probably 80% of my listeners are Rand supporters. So, I mean, all I'm doing is shooting myself in the foot by saying this. I'm doing nothing that helps me in any way. I am alienating four-fifths of my people.
No. Look, you mean well, obviously. He needs to have libertarian criticism. If the only people attacking him are attacking him for being too weak all the time, then he's going to pander. We've seen it. So we try to get him to flip from flop if that's the best we can do, I guess.
And I'll tell you, I'm tired of it being portrayed, like when people like Julie Borowski wrote a very effective letter about this. When people like that write these criticisms, the immediate response is, oh, you libertarians, you're all perfectionists. People have to be absolutely perfect for you to support them.
You prefer Hillary, I guess.
That has nothing to do at all with what I'm saying. I can't imagine anybody running for office being perfect. The point is not to be perfect. It's to be coherent. It's to stand your ground, even when the going gets tough. It doesn't mean you have to be perfect, but it means you have to have a philosophy. All right.
Yep.
He doesn't need me.
He doesn't need me. All he needs to do is read Ron's articles. Simple as that. Just read his father's archive. He writes every week, and he's good on everything. This is as simple as that. You know what? Look, let's talk about this a little bit more. Who cares about Yemen? Not anybody. I do, but look, the thing is, this is what was wrong with both of Ron Paul's campaigns, too. The ones led at the top was they went under. And how could you possibly argue against it? To them, the cookie cutter strategy, which is you run to the right in the primaries and then you moderate in the general election or whatever, that kind of thing. And they refused to latch on to the reality that Ron is changing the whole game and that the best electoral chance he had was to basically say to the entire American people, never mind Republican Party rank and file, this primary season is for you. Are you ready to take your government back from this oligarchy? This guy is changing the entire game. He's the only one who's willing to tell the truth about every single one of the Bill of Rights, every single one of the wars, and what's happened to your boom and bust cycle and your business and the rest of this, and run him as the game changer that he was. And of course, in every interview, every single interview in 07, 08, 11, and 12, he would say to Wolf Blitzer, man, you want to save Social Security, you got to end the empire or whatever. He was perfectly happy to speak quote unquote from the left. He didn't care about that. He just said what he wanted to say, what he thought was most important. But then the campaign ads all said Ron Paul was in the Air Force. And they didn't say Ron Paul was in the Air Force and he's anti-war. Not like the rest of these chicken hawks. They just said he was in the Air Force. Like he's the toughest nuclear bomber up there or something like that. And then he's the most anti-abortion and the most anti-Mexican of all the Republican candidates. And so the problem is, at least with Ron, it was just the campaign was run like that. It wasn't him. But with Rand, Rand is that campaign walking, basically. He is that mistaken idea that what he needs to do is, you know, kind of pander to all different sides rather than being so principled that he has something real for all different sides. You know what I mean?
I do. And I know that people will say, you know, he's probably the best U.S. senator we have. And, you know, Scott, he probably is. And there are a lot of things that he's done that other people wouldn't have done. And it's not that I don't appreciate those things. It's that I'm sad that I am a witness to what I fear will be a tremendous missed opportunity to build on something incredible. You remember those incredible days when Ron was running. Every day was a thrill. You went immediately to YouTube, as I said to Charles Goyette the other day, to see whose head just exploded today because of something Ron said on that guy's show, or, you know, or the huge crowds that came out to see him when he was saying things that absolutely nobody would say, not things that had been focus grouped or not things that were 10% different from Ted Cruz, but that were a million miles removed from that. And the people just kept coming and coming. Now, the thing was, Ron was surrounded by people who were traditional campaign types, who believe that a campaign is not the time to educate people. A campaign is a time to get votes. Now, I suppose if you're running a traditional campaign, that makes sense, that you just, who cares? You know, if you want to educate people, go start a school. But here, I'm trying to get a candidate elected. All right, fair enough. But Ron's running in a Republican primary against all the major interests that back that party. So he's probably not going to win. So he might as well do something that will both get votes, because he did do reasonably well in 2012 for a guy who basically wanted to start the whole country over again. I'd say he did pretty darn well. But will also get attention, will make a legacy of the man, will get important issues discussed. That was the type of campaign he needed to run, and that's the one that he ran himself every time he gave a speech, every time he was in public, every time he was on the media. That was the campaign he ran, but they were all trying to run the, well, we'll trick people into voting for him, because he's the Air Force guy who delivered babies. And by the way, that's wonderful, and I'm in favor of saying that he delivered babies and he was a family man, because that is good, because that is an entry point for some people. But you're not going to trick people into voting for him. That's an insult to people's intelligence. If they can vote for Huckabee, they're not going to vote for Ron. So go for the people that nobody's going for. Nobody's even reaching for. No one has reached for in years. That's how Ron raised all that money. That was not raised from people who have been voting in GOP primaries for the past 20 years. It was for people who haven't even bothered looking at a GOP primary in their entire lives. And he got to them. That was a new strategy, and that should have made them change the game, the way they were playing it. And unfortunately, it didn't. In fact, John McCain beat Ron in New Hampshire among anti-war people. Now, there is no excuse for that. There is no excuse for pitching Ron in such a way that McCain beats him among anti-war people. I mean, heads should have rolled. There should be bodies all over the floor for that.
Yeah, no, I remember that. And it was just a PR catastrophe. And, you know, I have no idea whether Rand had anything to do with that. But it's the kind of thing where if he was there, that would have been his advice. You know, what Jesse Benton thinks. Yeah, let's do that. Let's run him to the right on everything.
But I'm not.
It's just a failure of vision. That's
sure of that. I'm not really sure of that, because I mean, I don't know Rand super well, but I've met him and I've talked to him. And he sure seemed like a Ron Paulian to me. So, it could just be there's been a shift in strategy since election of the senator, whatever. But he was very enthusiastic about the Rally for the Republic that was held at the same time as the GOP convention. I mean, that's not a conventional GOP move by any means. Ron was sticking his finger in the eye of the whole GOP by holding that thing. So there is still a genuine maverick streak here, and so that's what makes the whole thing all the more puzzling. Listen, let's wrap things up here, Scott. I'll get you back to talk about Yemen at some point if things really gain further steam there, but I think it was good for me to just get this off my chest. And the thing is that the kind of people who would really, really rake me over the coals for this, I want him to succeed if he's going to be saying the things that he knows he should say, then I want him to succeed. I'm not actively campaigning against him. I'm not doing anything one way or the other. But the kind of people who would be, I know these people. If you say one tiny thing wrong about the way they're running a campaign, they will blacklist you. You will never be heard from again. But it happened to me. It happened to me in 2012. I was shut out of all kinds of things because of an exceptionally mild blog post I wrote. These people are childish people, but most of them, they already can't stand me anyway, so I don't think I'm really hurting myself by just on my own show saying, this is why I'm uncomfortable, because it's a massive, massive opportunity with a huge mailing list with committed people to say, yes, I dare to stand up and say the whole foreign policy is wrong. That's right. I know you're all against me on this stage, but doggone it, look around you, read the headlines. Who are you going to believe? These people are your own eyes. I mean, I doggone it, you know, to not have that opportunity. But as I say, Scott, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he'll run the whole campaign the way he ran the Megyn Kelly interview. And I will be the first one to come on this show and say, I was wrong, and I've never in my life been so happy to be wrong. Scott, thanks for being here. We'll get everybody over to scotthorton.org. I want to remind people that your show, the Scott Horton Show, the one that you do every single day for 2 hours a day to educate people primarily on foreign policy, is so important to me that I donate $100 to that show every single month. And I hope people who listen to you on my show will start listening to you on your own show, see the value in what you do, and join me in supporting you every month. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom.
All right, everybody. The show notes page for today is tomwoods.com/396. And if you haven't checked it out already, but you enjoy this show, I am fairly confident you will enjoy my new book, Real Dissent: A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. It's got a foreword by Ron Paul, and you can check it out at realdissent.com. And of course, as I've said before, I recorded the audiobook version of that book myself, so you can hear me reading it, and you can get that for free via the special offer available through tomwoodsaudio.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.